see, I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right, just so you can set it flat.
Hello, 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 hello.
This was a letter from COFO.
Oh, it was?
Yes, I intended to show it to you before.
May I have this?
Yes. Right. Let me read it for
you. All right, sure, sure.
Again, I don't remember what it said.
Well, I don't want to take it away from you.
No, I just brought it out. Yes, you can have it. It can go in your folder.
That's fine. I'll put it in my pocket for the moment. Maybe talk about that for a few minutes, or should we start with something more general?
Well, we can start at that point.
We can come back to that point, too.
Yes, I think we probably will be coming back to it, because I really don't know the answer to my immediate involvement in the civil rights struggle, except to say this, that my background from student days
yes.
has been in one of concern for the larger community. This started with student Y work and attendance at the World Conference of Christian Youth in Amsterdam, Holland back in 1939. At that, how personal do you want a person to be in this?
Well, as personal as you can,
all right.
You see.
Well, at that time I was engaged to a person who was not interested outside of business. And business was to be my background heritage. And when I came back from the experience of the Amsterdam Conference, we terminated our engagement because I saw that the dollar was not going to be the thing that must determine my whole life pattern, but people must be that. And I felt that a life with him would mean that the dollar would be the motivating factor and the primary thing, rather than involvement and concern about people. So that I grew so much in that one summer's experience from my exposures that I felt that the sort of person I would choose to spend my life with must be a person who had this other quality, rather than the business, perhaps, unless I could find one that combined both. So that's my first part of my answer to your question of my interest in the civil rights struggle, my own growth out of college, where I was concerned with people and peoples and how they develop and how they become mature and how they get the best life for themselves.
Where had you gone to college?
At Spalman College in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes, yes. One of that cluster of colleges.
That's right.
There, yes.
And I became president of Student Y there, mm-hmm. and went to student conferences, you know, in North Carolina. But the crowning thing was the overseas experience.
Yes.
And we studied with Sherwood Eddy that summer. You
yes.
Remember?
Yes, I remember.
And
yes.
We attached ourselves as a student youth group to his economic seminar that he took abroad for many years. And we got to know Dr. David Lloyd George and any number of persons of national and international stature.
Where were you raised?
I was born in Meridian, Mississippi, which is 90 miles from Jackson. Where
yes, I know where that is.
Are now. And we came to Jackson here when I was very young, 6, 7 years old, something like that. My family has been in the film business, and my immediate family, my mother and father, have been in the film business since 1915, but this particular business with which we associated with started back in 1903, and my dad came here to take over, to buy this particular business in the 20s, and that's when we moved to Jackson, Mississippi, so that I grew up here in Jackson, Mississippi.
Well, after the return from Amsterdam, that was in what year?
1939.
That was just before the war, then?
Just before the war. In fact, the war started while some persons were trying to get back, some of the persons in our group Juan Lucenio when it went down, and we were out in the water for many hours.
Yes, I remember the
yes,
event.
Yes. Of course, I think back of the why and its impact on my life was the church, because we've been very strict Methodists. My father had national responsibilities as a lay person in the Methodist Church, and I had traveled extensively with him to various Methodist meetings and so forth. So again, this was an exposure that made me interested in people. But,
I may interrupt it to check to see if
sure.
No, nothing's gone wrong here. It's always a little on the low side. It's closer to them. I'm sorry.
Pardon.
When did you and Dean Harvey get married? What was
your... We married in 1943. And we met on this experience that I told you about.
In Amsterdam?
And we met in Berlin prior to Amsterdam. He was traveling with the Methodist group, and he was one of the leaders of the World Conference of Christian Youth. By the time I met him, he had studied youth groups in 30 countries in the world and was quite an authority on youth movements. He had a background as president of the New York Youth Council and the first Negro president of the United Christian Youth Movement of North America.
When was that?
When was he president?
Yes, yes.
I don't know the years. That was prior to my meeting.
Oh, before that, I see.
It was prior to 1939.
I see. How much do you think the religious background has been important in this movement?
In the movement as a whole?
This is a controversial point, you know.
Well, I would say this, that religion per se has not been active in the movement as I know the movement. But many of the people who have been involved because of their religious orientation and their religious background. I don't think it has been the initiative of the church itself.
Not institutional, you mean?
Institutional, within the movement. But it has been religiously orientated people who have taken the leadership, like Martin Luther King,
yes,
for example.
Yes.
But I don't know how many people in his church would even follow him in
yes.
the movement, you see.
But you find a great deal of bitterness here and there from responsible people, responsible Negro leaders,
mm-hmm.
who will say, I am sick of Christianity. It's been the trap.
Yeah.
You know this argument, of
yes,
course.
Yeah.
On one hand that, on the other hand, the attitude typified by you and by Dr. Abernathy, Dr.
Mm-hmm.
King.
Yeah.
And it's a very subtle question, isn't it? There are all sorts of shadings.
Well, you see, I think this is because you have to differentiate between what Christianity has become in the way it has been lived and practiced and the way it has become institutionalized, and what Christianity really is, as Jesus, he didn't outline it, as we have it based on his teachings and his practices. And I think this is where the problem comes. For example, going up again back to the Amsterdam experience, those of us from America thought that European Christians were great sinners because they sat in sidewalk cafes and sipped beer and drank champagne. And yet when we went to take communion, they felt we were the worst Christians because we wore lipstick, you see. Well, there are many things that have become accretions to Christians, and we have said these are things that determine whether a person is Christian and whether they are, that have no basis at all in the fact. And I think that's where the problem lies.
Well, the accretions are personal and institutional and
that's right.
Generally social.
That's right. That's right.
May I read you...
And get away from the life of Christianity.
May I read you a quotation here about Dr. King's philosophy?
Yes.
This is by Dr. Kenneth Clark, the professor of psychology at CCNY now, as you know. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability, while black nationalism, he'd been talking about the Muslims before
yes.
this, betray pathology and instability. But a deeper analysis might reveal that there's also an unrealistic or pathological basis in King's doctrine. The natural reaction to injustice, oppression, and humiliation are bitterness and resentment. The forms which such bitterness take need not be overtly violent. The corrosion of the spirit seems inevitable. It would seem, therefore, that any demand that the victims of oppression be required to love those who oppress them puts an additional and intolerable burden upon them psychologically. That makes for the, well, what it says. To continue, the same source, it has been argued that the proper interpretation of King's philosophy of love must take into account its Christian, philosophical, and strategic significance. This argument may be perfectly correct for a small minority of educated and philosophically sophisticated individuals, but it is unlikely that it can be accepted with full understanding by the masses of Negroes. Their attempt to cope with this type of philosophical abstraction in the face of injustice can only lead to a deep and disturbing conflict and inner guilt.
Of course, I wouldn't be qualified to evaluate that because I don't know enough about psychology.
But you know people.
But my personal reactions would be these. Matter of nonviolent action, I think, toward the dominant group in American life has been the pattern of the Negro generally through the years. He would take the razor to himself to get his frustrations off or to within his own racial group on Saturday nights. That's where you have these cuttings where he beat his wife, but he never would take, I wouldn't say he never would, but very rarely you didn't have this overt thing against the dominant group. You had an identification, a feeling and concern for them, a sense of humor about them, laughing at their weaknesses and foibles, and also a sort of trying to outsmart them idea, which I think the Negro pattern of reaction in American life has been one toward this pattern of nonviolence. Toward the other group rather than away from it. Now, whether this has created within him additional frustrations, as Kenneth says that it would do, if, you know, the way it's used now, I don't know. But it seems to me that this is following a continuous pattern in the life of the Negro.
This would deny the Christian premise entirely, wouldn't it? The Christian values entirely.
What
to
would
forgive
deny?
Dr. Clark's statement.
Yes.
To forgive means to accept, create a conflict which is unhealthy.
Yes, that's right. That's true. Then the other thing is, I think it doesn't reckon with the three kinds of love that Dr. King talks about, you know, that he's talking about when you love, must love the other person, the agape type.
Yes.
Where you love him as a person of worth and you love him because in him too is the same spirit, that is a divine spirit that is in you. You don't love him as a brother, you don't love him sexually, you don't love him because of any of his physical attributes, and you don't love the things that he does to you or against himself, but you love him because he's a a child of God just as you are a child of God. And this is the type of love that he's talking about. And I think it's very important that we, you know, recognize.
You have known people, undoubtedly, who have been caught in violent situations in recent years. Negroes who have been caught in violent situations. And undoubtedly you know some who, on grounds not of fear or of tactics, have refused to be violent,
yes,
but have done so because of some theological or Christian or philosophical attitude. Do you see any corrosion of spirit in them, any extra burden of guilt, and any conflict, intolerable conflict in those people afterward?
No, I personally have not. I would think that they grow from this rather than get depleted by it. Now, with our young people, much of the nonviolence that they practice, they practice it, it seems to me, as a technique rather than as a way of life, or as, well, they have had it explained to them as a philosophy, but it's not growing out of a deep theological rooting Christian background. They have found it as a good technique. And then, of course, many people have said that the nonviolence that Martin Luther King advocates and practices is really not truly nonviolence according to the way Gandhi had it. It's become a mixed thing, I should say. It has many facets and many aspects in it.
Dr. Clark says again that the reason that Dr. King has been applauded is because he comforts the white man. He continues a stereotype of the Negro as, you know, non-resisting,
yes,
passive.
Applauded by whom?
By white people. He's been, you know, gets degrees and is advertised because he's comforting for the white man to think about.
Well,
is that notion, excuse me?
I don't know. That may be true. I don't know why.
Is that an idea, though, that he has, one that you encounter elsewhere among Negroes?
About King?
That the reason King is popular, is applauded by white people, is because he flatters their preconceptions.
No, I haven't ever heard that. Of course, they're not among Negroes. I've heard that black Muslims are read, that they say this about,
yes,
King.
Yes, they say that.
But I have never run into any individuals. But I have run into individual Negroes who react negatively to Dr. King because they felt that he was agitating too much. And that...
too much?
Yes, that he was agitating too much. How confidential is this?
Listen, I put it this way. It can be totally confidential. We will make it... Put up, the method is this. I will send a...
Say one is, if getting back to your original
fine,
question,
yes,
about my getting involved in civil rights, again, in my family, it goes back to the sort of family background that is mine. On my father's side of the family, there were this 85-year-old aunt who died right in this room here about 3 years ago and had lived with us 10 years ago. Father, who was my grandfather, tells that he and his brothers would not be beaten during slavery time. When they had some infraction, the master was angry with them. They would go hide out in the woods and stay until his temper cooled, and then they would come back. But they were such good workers on the place that he would just give them some minor punishment. But this is a sort of root background that I come in. This was right here in Mississippi. The family property is still down at Hazelhurst, so we still keep it in the family. Then on my mother's side of the family, my people were independent merchants, dating back to my great-great-grandfather, who evidently must have been a slave. And then after slavery, had set up a little business where he was a peanut vendor and would sell peanuts at the trains as they came into the stations there. emancipation.
After the Civil War, after emancipation.
After emancipation, in Meridian, Mississippi. And then his son, who was my great-grandfather, through hard work, my mother tells of him working so that the, when he would come in from the fields, you could hear the sweat sloshing in his boots, you know, he worked so hard and perspired, that he had got enough land in Lauderdale County to have a plantation and had many people working for him on the plantation and living as sharecroppers on the plantation. And then his daughter, who was my grandmother, married an Alabama man, and they were set up, instead of taking their share of the family property, acreage, they were given money to set up a business in Meridian, Mississippi. And I have in my files downstairs their contract for going in the grocery business, which was signed back in 1800 and something, where my great-grandfather, my grandfather, and my granduncle all go in this grocery business, to how much they put in and so forth, and the books of the business for years. Now, this business was operated for about 40 years until my grandfather got too old and he retired and came and lived here. Then, shifting back to my father's family again, my father was one of the founders of the NAACP here in Jackson, Mississippi. He and Mr. Noel and Mr. Dixon started it. And Miss Cox, who spoke at the meeting today, is an insurance agent that has been with us 30 years. And she tells that when my dad started the NAACP here, that for 2 or 3 years, that only 3 people would meet would be those 3 men. And then finally they would get able to get more people interested in working with it, and they started a youth council.
Now, what year was that when it was founded, roughly?
It was in the 20s, you
yeah.
see, because you see, my father came here in 24,
yes.
So this was 26, 27, 28, somewhere.
Pretty early then.
That's right. And then along, probably in the 30s, they started the first youth council, and I was a member of the first youth council, along with the daughters of the other 2 men. And the daughter of one of the men became Gladys Noel Bates as an adult, and filed the first suit for the equalization of teacher salary in the state of Mississippi. So here, again, as explanation of why I'm interested, involved in the civil rights, but is family background, tradition, the type of stock from which I come, that makes me interested in this sort of thing.
And the special energy of that stock, I
yes.
should say, too,
yes,
is
possibly.
clearly indicated
yes.
by the history.
Yes. Now, you were, we were talking about Mr. King, and I was wanting to say this when I asked you how personal, how private this was. One of my daily burdens is my own immediate staff in the office, my secretary, whom I inherited from my mother. See, my father's been dead since 39, and my mother has carried the businesses on since, and it's just... in the recent years that I've had to start commuting because her health and the growth of the business has meant that she wasn't able to function as she had. And so that the secretary we have has been with us 25 years this year. And she is one of the sort of people that believes everything white is right, you know, and is definitely not for the movement at all. And then also in the office is my husband's sister, who comes from an entirely different background, the northern background that he comes from, and all of that. And yet she falls right in the same pattern of this secretary who grew up here in Mississippi and worked for whites and learned to feel that they were superior to Negroes and all the rest of it.
Let me cut in on that point.
Yes.
This, you have raised a question I wanted to ask a little about. Some psychologists I know in New Haven told me that the new New Haven rebuilding program that is going on for the city, they have taken certain psychological tests for different groups to get their image of themselves. And among these are Negro groups. There's a test called the Rumor Test, where they take a picture, same picture, roughly the same picture always, several people, we'll say a white man is in the foreground, a Negro here and a Negro there, and they're just grouped around at random in the picture, with no necessary relation among them. They're not involved in the same action.
Yeah.
A white man in the foreground, will have a knife or a razor,
mm-hmm.
with making no threatening gestures with it, just holding it.
Mm-hmm.
Say 10 or 15 people are asked to look at the one person looks at the picture. He's then supposed to tell the next person about it. The next person tells the next one. Then the description is taken at the end, what is in the picture. And you see the nature of the test, of course.
Yeah.
It's an image that puts the knife out of the hand of the white man into the hand of the Negro in the picture. This, he says, is almost infallible.
Interesting.
It's extraordinary.
Very interesting.
Now, the question, of course, what motives are secretly operating to make that transfer?
Yes.
One motive, they attribute to it, is the self-image, white man's image of Negro as potentially violent,
mm-hmm.
or the associations. But is that all? Could there be other motives operating, you see,
mm-hmm.
secretly
yeah.
in this transfer?
Yeah.
When it's taken, when it occurs among Negroes in this series.
Yeah.
Could you think of any other motive that might be operating there besides the self-image of the violent person?
You mean in relationship to the
picture? Yes, when the Negro looks at the picture and takes a knife out of the white man's hand and puts it in his own,
mm-hmm.
in the course of telling it, somebody yes. slips, you see, somebody
yes.
transfers it.
Not at the moment, because I was still on another track of thought.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'll come back to it.
That's
maybe
all right.
Maybe I'll have a reaction to it. What I was trying to finish.
Please, I'm sorry.
When I was talking about these two persons in the office, was merely to bring out the fact that here are two people who react negatively against Martin Luther King.
Yes.
And against what we're trying to do in the movement. And I'm saying this is a daily burden that I have to bear because I don't feel like I can communicate that here's the employer-employee relationship, you see, which makes it very difficult for me to communicate to them. I try to keep posted on the bulletin board constantly all the things that are going on in the movement, and whenever there's an opportunity, we do discuss these things. But they are two people who feel that Dr. King is doing too much. I wish Martin Luther King would just going home tend to his business, but they feel that he's in it more for personal gain of merit and so forth, rather than for the thing that Kenneth Clark was indicating.
Yes, you encountered that notion here
yes,
and there.
Yes.
How widespread do you think that notion is?
I don't think it's very widespread, but I think it's unfortunate that you have people who can have great influence on other people holding that point of view, and not really realizing what the movement is about and what is happening in it. I just wanted to finish that.
Please.
Thought. There was another thought back there when we were talking about that I wanted to get into the hopper when you were talking about this nonviolence on the part of Negroes. There is the feeling now, and COFO people will perhaps verify this. I got this from the civil rights hearings here recently and listening to people talk, that they feel that they've been patient too long and that the Justice Department is not doing anything about their redress on their grievances. And therefore, they feel that they must take things in their own hands. And here you have the possibility of violence erupting from the Negro group against the white group.
Is that taking things in their own hands? What would that mean? What literally, concretely, specifically would that mean?
Well,
or might it mean, of course?
Well, it would mean a fight. It would mean a mob violence. It would mean physical action with knives, guns, and what have you. Now, what this will solve nothing. It'll compound the problem, the way I personally feel about it. But they just feel that this stuff is just so built up in them, and all these frustrations, the things we heard today about going down, and then there are no exemption slips. One of the patterns that came out in the civil rights hearing was that they go down to register, and the register disappears, you know. And so they stay there all day, nobody there, you know. And then somebody comes and says, well, we've got to close up now, you have to come back tomorrow. You see, all these harassments and frustration are just at the explosion point, a lot of people. And they think they just let it explode and spill over on the people who have been perpetrating it. So that it's a very real thing now in Mississippi, and it may get entirely away from all the nonviolence that Martin Luther King is calling himself preaching.
Do you think that the spillover with selected targets, as it were, a white man offends a Negro and
no.
gets violence, or with spillover by just
indiscriminate? It would be uncontrolled.
Just an explosion.
Yes.
Any man, white, any child,
yes.
white,
yes.
anyone
yes.
gets it.
Yes.
He's passing.
Yes. Yes. It would be uncontrolled.
Yes.
This is my feeling.
But before the break would come, it would be it reached the point of the indiscriminate.
That's right. That's right. Well, this was a recurring thing said over and over again at the last civil rights hearing here at the United States Commission.
I attended the nonviolence conference at Howard University last November,
mm-hmm.
and there was some talk. Well, I'll cut back. There was a great deal of criticism of Dr. King's program.
I see.
Great deal.
Mm-hmm.
But you had a kind of scale, a spectrum,
mm-hmm.
going down to the fear of violence of this sort.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, a considered policy of the brinksmanship of violence, or violence short of the lethal,
mm-hmm.
was discussed as actual policy, a coldly calculated policy,
mm-hmm.
not an explosion.
I see.
But a policy.
Yeah.
Say not to kill, but to destroy property or blow bridges as a possibility, or the matter of the threat played with constantly of violence.
Yeah, come in.
How are you doing?
All right.
Been
this is Mrs. Moore, Dr. Warren.
How are you, Mrs. Moore?
Mm-hmm. Warren.
Warren.
Uh-huh. Dr. Warren has written several books.
Well, you were telling me at the table about the Freedom Riders, and you were entering the
yes,
civil rights
movement. I was really trying to get back to a direct answer to your initial question
yes.
of my involvement in the civil rights movement. And the immediate thing that projected me into it at this moment was the coming of the Freedom Riders back in May of 1961. Of course, you know from our booklet that Woman Power Unlimited issued, and I sent you earlier, that we had been sent by the bishop of our area, the Methodist bishop of our area, for my annual conference on the coast to Jackson to see the persons who had been jailed and to attend the first hearing. And it was out of this first hearing that I noticed that some of the girls did not have sweaters, and when we inquired we found that one needed a sweater. It was very cool, although it was late May. And our minister, Reverend E.A. Mays of Central Methodist Church, was kind enough to take one of my sweaters back to the jail and give it to the young lady. This was on Friday. I can give you the exact date if you wish it.
If you have it,
I have
hand it.
Just hold it.
All right.
This was on Friday, May 26, 1961. And then on Saturday, May 27th at night, I was talking with Attorney Jack Young's wife, and she was saying that since the young people were not taking bond and were staying in the community, they found that they had many, many needs. And she had sent pajamas up by her husband. So this planted the seed within me of the need that the people were going to have if they remained in our community for 39 days when they had not come prepared to stay. And the other factor was that at the hearing, it came out very clearly that these people had never intended to be arrested in the first place. You see, they were sort of captured in coming from Alabama to Mississippi. They were escorted by the police on the buses, and they were not allowed restroom there was no restroom on the bus, and they made no stops so that they could use restrooms. And the testimony at the trial indicated that one minister, Y.T. Walker, had asked person in charge of the bus, the military person, police power in charge of the bus, to please stop and let them use the restroom. And he had been told to just go to the back of the bus and use it. And he said, well, there are women there. He said, so what? So when they got to Jackson, all of them had this tremendous physical urgency. And they drove up to the Greyhound bus station, the Trailway bus station. And the door to the, what was the Negro waiting room, had out of order sign on it. So that they were funneled by this line of police that was standing there into the white restroom, white waiting room. And they rushed on to the white restroom, and there, in the process of blood evacuation, they were arrested. Well, now, they hadn't planned any of this, hadn't intended to do it, but they were forced into it and to their arrest. So after it had been forced on, then they decided to make the most of it, and James Farmer was a part of that particular group. So woman power, so the next morning, this Sunday morning after talking with Mrs. Young on Sunday night, right in this room, the idea came to me to call some of the churches and ask if they would make a contribution to help provide for some of the physical needs of the Freedom Riders who were going to be staying here, and to send me two women from each of the churches. So by Sunday afternoon, we had 12 women and at least $75 in hand. And from that small beginning, we were able to get 150 or 200 women to work across the summer in providing for the needs of these persons. And monies came to us from local groups and from individuals as well as from people across the country. And we did, the sort of thing we did was to send them in clothing and toilet articles and writing paper and that sort of thing. We could not go ourselves as women. We had to send it by ministers or by a lawyer. And we went on some occasions, and we were constantly asked, well, are you a licensed minister? No. Well, then you can't go in. This was our thing.
Only ministers come out.
Only ministers are lawyers. And then, of course, they sent many of the Freedom Riders up to Parchment after there's so many of them came. And while they were at Parchment, we could do nothing for them. We sent things to them, but the things were not given them. And when they came back to Jackson, then we would meet them at the jails and take them to our homes and to churches and what have you to feed them and to get them cleaned up. And then it was recorded in James Peck's book on the Freedom Ride, as well as in many articles, Ladies Home Journal, Jet, and many of the national and local publications, Negro and White, recorded that many of the Freedom Riders said that their sanity was maintained while they were under these torturous conditions in this tremendous heat and with the brutal treatment they were receiving up at Parchment, because they knew that back in Jackson, Mississippi, there were a group of women who were concerned and interested and who represented something of the mind of the community. They felt that they weren't, their efforts were not being wasted.
You think that many people here were waked up by that change there?
Yes, I think that the presence of the Freedom Riders did more for Jackson Negro community than anything that I know was happening in my years of living here, because we were very disunified. We had no sense of unity at all on social issues as Negroes. And I felt this way about it, that particularly for our young people who got in on the act and they got jailed with some of the freedom riders, that some of them heard of Yale University, for example, for the first time because they were a cellmate with somebody who studied at Yale or who happened to mention Yale. They heard of universities and colleges that they never heard of before. They heard of professions that were open that they never even thought they never heard of before, and they found out that Negroes did go into the... It gave them an ideal and a cause and a hope and an exposure that they hadn't had, and it was one of the best things in the world. So that besides unifying the community, it did tremendous much for our young people in giving them goals and some motivation to go.
I hadn't thought of that aspect of it.
Yes, this was tremendous. And it also brought courage to the community. It was another factor. The fact that the people felt, we began to look at ourselves and say, well, you know, maybe we ought not to be just so satisfied living as we are. Maybe there is another way of life that's possible right here. Maybe we don't have to send our children to Los Angeles and to New York and Chicago and Detroit for jobs when they get educated. Maybe we can get the jobs right here if we do certain things for ourselves within our community. And as long as we have the people who are going to help open our eyes and make us see opportunities that are right here and who are willing to help us, well, why not stay here and do something about it?
James Baldwin writes in his last book, as a matter of fact.
Is this The Fire Next Time?
Yes. But the Southern mob does not represent the majority will of the South. He says this is based on a testimony of those best qualified to observe. Those people being the actual embattled fighters, he says, on the Southern front.
Mm-hmm.
Would that seem to make sense to you?
I think that makes sense. I think, though, that it's the mob, of course, is the one that gets the publicity, you see, and so forth. But I think the real tragedy in the South is the people of goodwill who remain silent and who let the mob take over and exert the pressures and get the publicity.
Baldwin goes on to say that the mob fills a moral vacuum. What you are saying, I guess.
Yes, right, yes.
The other forces can't find a way of expression.
Yes, yes, the other forces are not courageous enough to find a way of expression. I feel that they could if they would.
Is it a problem of organization, too? Finding a focus for organization?
A lot of the problem is the problem of leadership. Now, this leadership may take a form of getting people organized, or it may not. But I think the lack of leadership has been great in the white group as well as in the Negro group, because so many of our best people have been siphoned off, white and Negro, to other areas, because they haven't been able to find the job opportunities and the economic security that they needed within the community. You have thousands moving away every year, white and Negro, from your best minds.
Yes, Mississippi has been sort of the seedbed of manpower for the country for a long time.
Yes, yes. So in these people that have left, there may have been many resources that would have given us the sort of leadership that we needed to keep the mob in its proper place. Of course, they say this is why the Citizens Council was organized, to prevent mob violence and to get moderate control, but it hasn't worked out this way.
I don't believe that myself.
No. Well, maybe it was just a statement. I mean, maybe this isn't the reason why it was organized, but this is what many... I've talked with some people who are Citizens Council people, and they said this is why they came in, to give them moderates. But if it is the reason, this is not the way it's worked out.
No, no. there's another notion associated with that, of this.
May I
please
interrupt you?
Yes, please
again.
Do. Please.
I'm still trying to not be the politician and go off on tangents without your questions, but I think we ought to get into the hopper. The thing that I was saying again about why I'm interested.
Oh, please do.
This involvement with the Methodist Church on a national level as a member of the General Board of Christian Social Concerns was another springboard, you see, for me to get into the present civil rights struggle in the local community. For me, it was not enough to have a national responsibility, a national position with this board, and do things nationally and not get that same thing working within my own local community. So now maybe I have answered fully your initial question.
Well, we may get some more ideas later. Even on it. The old question, which is we hear over and over again, put in one form or another, can there be a solution for, quotes, the Negro problem without a solution for, quote, the poor white problem in the South?
I would think not. I think the two have to go hand in hand. And I don't think you can help one without helping the other. And I don't think you should help one without helping the other. One of the major problems in the South that has affected both groups is economics. And it's reflected in poor education for whites as well as poor education for Negroes. And if this problem of economics has helped, then it should spread across the board, and this will mean a tremendous amount to our state. And one of the things that I'm tremendously interested in, and if you have any contacts that would be helpful, is to get into Mississippi some small manufacturing businesses.
I have none.
Contacts with people who could tell us how you go about it. Something that doesn't require a lot of capital, but it would put 30 or 40 people to work and give them economic security, because this is a tremendous need here, which reflects in this lack of economic security and meeting basic economic needs reflects in all of the aspects of our culture. And our isolation ideas on religion, our Bible-centered thinking there, and in our race attitudes and mob violence and other things. I think it's really fundamental.
How is unemployment here?
How is unemployment?
Yes.
It's, I couldn't give you the percentages, but it's, we have more than we should. And you see, much of it's displacement in Mississippi by automation, the cotton picking machines. And you could see it for yourself if you just traveled from here to Memphis, Tennessee, the vacant hovels on the plantations, you see, just empty.
That had begun some years ago.
Yes, it has begun several years ago. But it continues. And the migration into town, you see, they left the plantations and they've come into town.
What about the relief situation? Is there discrimination on that in Jackson? Well, does anybody know how much it is?
I don't know how much there is.
I hadn't heard it said about Jackson, but it said about other places.
Yes, I don't know. I wouldn't know. Jackson is pretty typical of the other places, so if it's ever in other places, I'm certain it would be here too.
You said earlier that improvement would have to come through a number of forces operating at the same time.
Yes,
I
think,
right?
I think I said that we were discussing this
yes,
at dinner.
Yes.
And I felt you were saying that you had attended a conference where Martin Luther King and his approach was greatly criticized.
Yes.
And that Mr. Clarence Mitchell indicated that he believed a great deal in the political approach.
Yes.
And other people at the conference felt that this was not good at all. And I was saying that it's my feeling that there's no one way to solve the problem. that's mutually exclusive of other ways, there must be many forces and different types of approaches to the problem, because you're working with different kinds of problems and you're working with different kinds of peoples and different situations. Therefore, what will be good in one place may not necessarily be good in another. But it doesn't mean that this is no good because it doesn't work in a particular situation. Therefore, I think there must be many approaches to the problem, many different fronts on which people work, and many different techniques used.
Well, with that in mind, I've cut back to the question, the relation of the Negro to the poor white,
yes.
The dispossessed white or the ignorant, uneducated white. Mm-hmm. Can you envisage a policy which would involve the amelioration of the white man's situation too?
Well,
is there any basis for cooperation, for comprehension at that level, or of a policy that would involve both Negro and white?
I think that there would be, from the standpoint of a policy, which would have to come from above down. But I don't know how much cooperation you would get on this particular level unless you had a very strong leadership. Would you hold that there just a minute?
Sure.
Well, now, getting back to this question of the poor whites and the poor Negro getting rapport and a working relationship, I think it can be done. I can't tell you how, because I don't really feel that they have great antipathy for each other. I think they have been used by the power structure, pitted against each other, you see,
mm-hmm.
And that they really don't have deep-seated resentments against each other and could work together if they were given an opportunity to do so. And certainly if they felt they were going to better themselves, each group better themselves by a cooperative working relationship. I had an experience the other day sitting in the bus station in Hammond. I was sitting in what was formerly the white side of the station. The only Negro sitting in there, all the Negroes, other Negroes, were sitting where they have been accustomed to sitting before the law changed. And I had eaten breakfast and took a seat, and one seat removed from a white lady sitting there. And she leaned over to me and said, "Are you an insurance lady?" And I realized that I had one of my business briefcases, and that's why she asked that. And we began to talk. She didn't have any, she was definitely poor white, and she didn't seem to have any resentment because I was there, and she didn't mind the other people staring because we were talking, and she was talking about some of her personal problems, why she had to go to Baton Rouge and so forth, and I think this is a pretty typical kind of person, and if she could get a job somewhere where other people were working and they were all going to be benefited by it, I don't think we'd mind.
To extend that, there's another statement that only the Negro situation tied to the poor white situation, with the other notion, to quote, "The South cannot change until the North changes." This is said over and over again by Bowen, by many sociologists. The root lies is a national root to the problem, not a sectional root.
Yes, yes. Well, I think the problem is an international problem, for that matter. The problem of race and the problem of minorities and the problem of using peoples is not. I think colonialism is another facet of the same type of problem. So I think it's a worldwide problem. But I don't think you could say that the South won't change until the North changes. That would not be my feeling. I'm hoping, and my reason for remaining in the South and working in the struggle is because I'm hoping the South will point the way, because the problem is so serious and intense here. I hope we can point the way for the whole nation, for that matter. And it's interesting, you know, noticing how peoples in other countries, Africa particularly, are gaining respect for us in America because of the stand we are taking in the civil rights struggle. For example, when I was in Ghana in 1962, I was there for the World Without the Bomb Peace Conference, and Madam Jaggi, who is a judge in the Supreme Court there, a Ghanaian woman, said to me after taking Mrs. Wadsworth through the YWCA in Ghana, "My dear, you American whites are so childish." And I said, "What do you mean, Madam Jaggi? She said, "They lean over backwards, being nice to us here, and yet we read about how when they go home, they kick you in the teeth." I said, "How do you think that the mother feels when they are nice to the mother and they mistreat the child?" Well, now, this was a different idea to me altogether, because the Africans that I had known who'd come over here to study looked down on me and other Negroes because we have been slaves, our heritage, a slave background, and they said they'd never had. And they never seemed to want to identify with us socially or anyway. But now here's this whole new respect for us, looking upon us as the children of the mother Africa, because we are now asserting ourselves and merely reminding the people in America that there are certain rights under the Constitution that were guaranteed to us that we just haven't gotten. We're a little late getting.
Speaking of Mother Africa, that notion, years ago in reading Du Bois, I came across for the first time in my experience a discussion of what I think he calls a split in the psyche of the American Negro. He says on one hand there's the pull toward the mystical view of blackness, toward the African heritage, toward the community of feeling and loyalties based on that inheritance and on the not a sense of a social situation of cramp and oppression and exploitation, but some mystic identification. This being one impulse, the other impulse is toward entering the Western European American cultural tradition, and in the process, perhaps eventually, losing all identity.
Yes.
This is the vision of loyalty and feeling. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yes.
I hate to disturb you, but I just want to say to Dr. Warren that I'm getting out.